Okay, so in studying the Synoptic Gospels, and that's those first three Gospels of your New Testament, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we're taking a look today at Matthew chapter 20, Mark chapter 10, and Luke chapter 18. And really studying about that episode where, first of all, Jesus predicts his death. Jesus also, secondly, is asked a question by the mother of James and John, wanting to put James and John on the right and the left hand of Jesus in his kingdom. And so Jesus has a dialogue with them about what real service is and the importance of being a servant. And I'm also going to think about a healing of Jesus where two beggars come to him. One of those is named in I believe, Mark's gospel, Bartimaeus. But two blind beggars come to Jesus and he heals them. So that's what's on the docket for today. And you can choose which text you want to look at. I've got my marker in Matthew 20, so that's what I'll be taking a look at. But as we read, we're going to read all three of these texts combined together. If we take all three of these and we were to put them in a New King James Version format, this is what all three texts combined together would look like in Matthew 20, 17 through 19, Mark 10, 32 through 34, and Luke 18, 31 through 34. It says, "Now they," and that's specified in one of the texts, "Jesus and the 12 were on the road, going up to Jerusalem." Up in elevation is the idea there when it says going up. "Going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was going before them. And they were amazed, and as they followed, they were afraid. Then he took the 12 aside again and began to tell them the things that would happen to him and said to them, 'Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem. And all things that are written by the prophets concerning the Son of Man will be accomplished. And the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes. And they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. They will mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him and crucify him. And the third day he will rise again.' But they understood none of these things. This saying was hidden from them, and they did not know the things which were spoken." Okay, so Jesus is very specific here. He is more specific here than he has been in any other text concerning what lies ahead for Jesus. And so that gets us into our first question here. What does he tell his disciples that's going to specifically happen to him? What do we see him specifically telling them? It's not just, "I'm going to die." I mean, if that's all Jesus ever said in terms of prediction, well, I guess we all could call ourselves a prophet because we could all probably predict we're going to die. Jesus says a lot more specifically than just, "I'm going to die." What specifically does he say that would indicate to us the prophetic ability of Jesus as we think about what he says to his disciples here? A lot of details about things.
That he'll be betrayed and condemned.
Okay, betrayed, all right. So not that, you know, "I'm going to die because I fall off a cliff," or no, not because the enemies are going to, no, because actually one of my friends is going to betray me and I'm going to be condemned. Okay, so there's going to be a trial is the idea. So Jesus is predicting a trial when he predicts a condemnation. Keith had a hand, and then Art.
Yeah, he cites what was pronounced in the Old Testament. I can recall a lot of the descriptions from Isaiah where they correlate with what Jesus was telling his disciples.
Okay. Right? So he connects some of this to Old Testament prophets. There's been some things prophesied, and these things are going to be fulfilled. Art?
Also, he says all things will be accomplished pertaining to Jesus. So this would destroy the thousand-year reign and all this stuff.
Okay. That's an interesting point. Yeah. Everything's going to be accomplished, you know, pretty soon here. Right, down the road. And so that's a good point. So we think about the premillennial doctrine that we're still waiting on some prophecies to be fulfilled. This has been fulfilled. Dwight, you had a hand up earlier.
Yeah, he was going to be scourged.
Scourged. Yeah. So he actually predicts not just that I'm going to die, but I'm going to be scourged before I die. It says spit upon, as well. I'm going to be mocked. All of those things he specifically states, which is pretty interesting when you look at the detail as to what he was saying. Take a look at this chart here where I've actually kind of listed it all out for you. The Son of Man shall be delivered, betrayed to the chief priests. So that predicts the betrayal of Judas. They shall condemn him to death. So that predicts the Jewish condemnation of the innocent Jesus. They shall deliver him to the Gentiles. So that predicts the Roman approval of the sentence, because the Romans had to approve of a capital punishment, because really the Jews were subject to the Romans. And so Jesus specifies that. They shall mock him, spit upon him. That predicts the mockery endured at the hands of the soldiers and others. They will scourge him, that Dwight mentioned. That's the beating that Jesus would receive. They will kill and crucify him. So he predicts the manner of death by which he will die. So he knows this is not accidental. I'm not going to die by having my head chopped off. There's no guillotine. This is crucifixion is going to be the manner of death, an extremely torturous type of death, and he predicts his resurrection. Despite all these specific predictions, how do the disciples respond to this? Dwayne?
So just a question with this, right? Because of the wording, it says it was hidden from them. Mm-hmm. So does that mean that they were intentionally kept ignorant by the Holy Spirit? Or what does that mean when the text says it was hidden? Because when I see that, I think about like Old Testament, you know, when Moses came to Pharaoh and it said, you know, Pharaoh's heart was hardened and he would say no, right? And so we see this idea that it was hidden. And then we see after Jesus comes back that when the Holy Spirit, you know, came upon them, that they had that recollection of everything that they were taught. Mm-hmm. Is this one of those things where, you know, Jesus was specifically saying these things and they just were not given the ability to comprehend, or were they just being immature and not listening to? I mean, Jesus was very specific.
Yeah.
Right? And so the wording that we use in that phrase of it was hidden from them, what, how do you reconcile what that means? Because it almost seems like it was something, for lack of a better term, supernatural. Right? Hmm. There was some reason why they didn't have the ability to understand.
Yeah. My take on that's always just been, without any official commentary quotes here, my take on that's always just been, they just didn't get it. And sometimes I don't think you get things until you go through things. My children are a perfect example of that, you know? You can tell them, hey, you need to really save your money because trust me, one day you're gonna need that money, that you're working for right now. Don't spend everything you get. And until you become an adult and actually go through a hard time and realize, yeah, I should have listened to mom and dad. Or you can tell them about situations with your friends. Here's how you should handle that. And they just kind of goes over their head, right? Until they actually go through the moment. And it's interesting that when Jesus has gone through everything, what we see in Luke 24, for example, is he kind of goes back through everything that he'd already told them, but he has to get specific with them again. And take a look at verse 44 and 45 of Luke 24. Verse 44 says, "These are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you." He tells them, "I told you this while I was still with you, that all things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me." And he opened their understanding that they might comprehend the scriptures. They didn't get it before it happened. And I'm not sure how, you know, it was hidden in terms of could this have been a supernatural or just a situation where I can't fathom Jesus having to go through all this. Somebody who's done so much good, so many good things. Why would this happen to him? I don't know. But
Jesus was very specific. Mm-hmm, he said, "This is what's going to happen." You know, like you said, "This is my manner of death." These are, I don't understand. Like, if you came to me and said, "Hey, you know, this is going to happen," let's say you had some prophetic gift and you were able to say these things, and then they started to happen, I would be like, "Wait a minute, Josh, that up." Right? Like, I don't. It's really hard for me to fathom, like, how they could not, having witnessed everything they saw with Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how they couldn't hear those words and have comprehension of them, other than something, you know, like I said, that phrase of it was hidden from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It's very specific.
Right. Right. Extremely.
Yeah. You know, really, when you, I think when sometimes when you look back to it, is look at know that they sent word to John to tell him before he would be beheaded that you seen this and there. It's almost like being reinsured or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's kind of the same thing with the apostles that happened to John.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's easier for us, I think, in hindsight to look back and say, why didn't they get it? But you're right. Even while being with Jesus and being told specific things, they still had their moments of doubt, their moments of, for lack of a better word, denseness. They were just a little dense about things sometimes, didn't sink through. And, I think we've all been in that situation, though, where we've been told, here's what's going to happen, and until it happens, it doesn't really click with us. And
I think we've all had teachers or professors that could explain things better, that we understood them better than maybe a previous teacher we've had.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe for whoever was writing, which here in Luke, it was Luke, maybe he interpreted that he could understand it better at that point in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for Matthew, it might have been at a different time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good points, good thoughts. Let's take a look at question two here. Looking at John's gospel, okay, because we got a lot more text to look at. Looking at John's gospel, and we're not going to John too much, but I think just for this particular point, I want to take a look at where we are contextually here. How did disciples feel about going into Judea? Because I just want to highlight just a word that's used in one of the texts. I can't remember if it's Luke or the Mark text, but it says they're afraid. And Jesus takes them aside that's why he takes them aside, to get specific. Here's what's going to happen. But why were they afraid to go into Judea? Take a look at John 11, verses 7 through 16. Verse 7. After this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." And the disciples said, "Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and are you going there again?" Now, when we realize this context, that this is what they had recently been through, they wanted to kill you last time, you know, you were around some of the rabbis. Are you sure you want to do this? And Jesus said, you know, Jesus responds to them and tells them why. Because our friend Lazarus sleeps. I need to go there so that I can wake him up. And Jesus spoke of Lazarus's death. He was going to raise him from the dead. Verse 16. Verse 15 says, "Now verse 16, Thomas, who is called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, 'Let us also go that we may die with him.'" So basically disciples say, "Jesus, last time you went here, some of the rabbis wanted to stone you." And Jesus is like, "Well, I'm going because I'm going to go raise Lazarus from the dead." And Thomas says, "Well, let's all go and let's all die for Jesus." So that's how afraid they were. They could feel the tension that existed between Jesus and some of the religious leaders of his day. And then after the resurrection of Lazarus, the resurrection seems to significantly increase the risk. If you take a look at verse 47 of John 11, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs." And that's just the craziest statement to me. What are we going to do about Jesus? Because he's doing a lot of good things. And we don't want him to get more popular among the people. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. And one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said, "You know nothing at all, nor do you consider it's expedient for us that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." And he didn't say this on his own authority, but being high priest, he prophesied Jesus would die for the nation. Take a look at verse 53. "From that day on, they plotted to put him to death." And so the disciples seem to know that these types of plots are taking place. And so it says, "Jesus no longer walked openly among the Jews, but he went from there into the country near the wilderness to a city called Ephraim, and there remained with his disciples." So this is what's going on. Verse 57 also says, the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where Jesus was, he should report it, that they might seize him. So they knew that there was a bounty out for Jesus, that there were, you know, most wanted signs out all over the place for Jesus. And that's why they're afraid. And that's why Jesus takes a moment to take them aside, to let them know, well, this is specifically what's going to happen. don't think it fully clicked with them, but this is why there's fear, there's amazement that Jesus is even going to go back to Judea, because they could feel that this was going to be a setup. You're going to be in trouble when you go here. So that's the situation. Now, something that I want to remind you of is something we studied last week. But in Matthew 19, what is Jesus' promise in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 28? Can somebody read Matthew 19 verse 28 for us? Robert, I haven't heard your deep voice this morning. Matthew 19 verse 28. Can you read that for us?
So Jesus said to them, "Assuredly I say to you, that in the regeneration, when the Son of Man sits on the throne of his glory, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel."
Okay, thank you. And so taking a look at that context, I think that helps set us up to understand why we're going to read what we do in Matthew chapter 20. Jesus has promised that you're going to sit on 12 thrones. James and John's mother is thinking very literally about those 12 thrones, that, well, I would like my two children to be on the right hand and the left hand of Jesus when they sit on these literal thrones. She's thinking very literally. And so that is most likely what prompts the request that we see in Matthew chapter 20. They think Jesus is going down to Judea. He's going to set up a literal kingdom, that's still in mind, a physical kingdom. Perhaps they're going to have to fight. And after you conquer, then let's have James and John be on both sides of you. They still don't get that Jesus is headed to Jerusalem to die for the sins of the world so that he can be the king, not just of the nation of Israel, but so that he can be the king of kings, of all people, of all nations, reigning in a spiritual kingdom. So with that background, let's read the text. Matthew 20, 20-23. It says, "The mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he said to her," now she doesn't arrogantly, by the way, notice, she kneels down. She gives him reverence and worship, in a sense. So it's a very respectful request. I think it's well-intentioned, just doesn't understand that it's offensive to some of the other disciples. And certainly doesn't understand the nature of the kingdom. "But he said to her, 'What do you wish?' And she said to him, 'Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand, the other on the left, in your kingdom.' And then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him saying, 'Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask.' And he said to them," so one text has it kind of his mother, their mother talking, the other text has it James and John talking, maybe they all came together. "But he said to them, 'What do you want me to do for you?' And they said to him, 'Grant us that we may sit, one on your right hand, the other on your left, in your glory.' But Jesus answered and said, 'You do not know what you..." Sorry, my clicker's stalling on me. Oh, there it is. Stay. No, it went back again. There we go. I'm only going to hit it one time. "Jesus answered and said, 'You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?' They said to him, 'We are able.' So Jesus said to them, 'You will indeed drink my cup, the cup that I drink, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it's for those for whom it is prepared by my Father.'" All right. So what's the request? First of all, we already mentioned that, right? It's, "Let my two sons sit on your right hand and your left hand." And we've already mentioned what Jesus had previously said that may have led to this request. He talks a little bit about these 12 thrones that they seem to understand as literal thrones in the kingdom. Let's look at the fourth question. Jesus asks, "Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink?" What is the cup?
Suffering.
Okay, good. If you look at Matthew chapter 20, 22 and 23, says, are you able to drink the cup? And then in verse 23, he says, you will indeed drink my cup. So let's take a look at how the term cup is used, because I think this will be helpful to understand Jesus is not talking literally. To understand how Jesus is using the term cup, we have to kind of examine some context, see how the term cup is used. So just really quickly, look at some of the Psalms. The one we're probably most familiar with would be Psalm 23 and verse 5, right? My cup overflows. David's not talking about a literal cup overflowing. He's just speaking figuratively that he's very blessed. Psalm 16 and verse 5 is another one of the Psalms where the term cup is used in this figurative way. Verse 5, O Lord, you are the portion of my inheritance and my cup. You maintain my lot. My cup, my lot. Cup is not literal here. The Lord is not literally inside of the cup of David in Psalm 16. He's speaking in a figurative sense when this word is used. Matthew 26, we also see verses 39 and 42. O my Father, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus prays, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. He's not drinking anything right here. There's no literal cup here. The cup is what he's about to suffer. It's his lot. It's his fate. He knows that he's about to have to go through suffering and then the cross. Let this cup pass from me. Verse 42, O my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me, unless I drink it, in other words, unless I go through it, unless I experience it, your will be done. And so the term cup is used in these various senses. It's used that way in Revelation as well. You'll see a couple other Old Testament references, Isaiah 51, Jeremiah 25. But I think that's important to note as we think about the term cup and as we think about the term baptism. Sometimes cup is not always literal. Sometimes we're metaphorically talking about the cup. Thayer's actually defines the cup. He says the word cup is defined in two ways. It's a cup, a drinking vessel. When they took communion, they did take a literal cup and drank a literal drink out of the cup. It was symbolic of something, but it was a literal cup they were drinking out of. But the second definition from Thayer is it is also used metaphorically as one's lot or one's experience, whether joyous or adverse. And so in Psalm 23, my cup overflows. I'm living a joyful life because the Lord is my shepherd, is the point of Psalm 23. I'm happy because the Lord is taking care of me, and I have nothing to fear when the Lord takes care of me. And so there's the joyous side of the cup, but also Jesus is talking about the adverse side of the cup, his divine appointment. Sometimes that's favorable, sometimes that's unfavorable, but Thayer goes on to point out, whether favorable or unfavorable, these are likened to a cup which God presents one to drink. Prosperity, whether it be prosperity, whether it be adversity. So the term cup is used in that sense. And just like the term cup is not always literal, the term baptism is not always literal either. How is the term baptism used in Scripture, actually? We see it used several different ways. Can you think of a couple times we're not talking about literal baptism in water like we think of? Mary Beth?
Situation when Jesus gives it three times, well, in the combined sentences, that it really is talking about, are you able to be immersed in what I'm about to be immersed in?
Right, right. And so it's what you're immersed in is probably the key consideration as we consider context. Why do we teach a literal water baptism for remission of sins? Well, because we have examples of people like the Ethiopian eunuch going literally down into the water and coming up out of the water. And so that baptism is a water baptism. But what kind of baptism is Jesus talking about here? It's this baptism being immersed in suffering, being immersed in pain, immersed in torture, immersed in mockery. And so that's the baptism he says, I'm going to go through. And you're going to go through it eventually too. Maybe not right now, but you're going to go through it too. And you need to consider, if you want to be part of my kingdom, this is actually part of being part of my kingdom. It's not all glory and just sitting on thrones and telling people what to do from your throne. It's suffering. It's service. It's work.
To see how Jesus uses the term baptism several different times, this is a good example. So when we talk to others, take a tangent, talk to others about baptism, sprinkling, pouring, other means of it, everything we see is an immersion of some kind, along with the definition of the word.
Mm-hmm. Good. There were a couple other hands out there, and I saw them in my peripheral. Dwayne?
So John the Baptist, in the beginning of Matthew, talks about he baptizes with water, but the one that comes after him will baptize with the Holy Spirit and with fire.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so he's not talking about Jesus literally putting people into fire. Mm-hmm. He's talking about that judgment.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, it's a less literal and more of a figurative way of letting them know this is what's going to happen.
So context is key. Baptism of the Spirit, baptism of fire, baptism of suffering, baptism of water. We see at least four different senses of how the word baptism is used in Scripture. And here's just a slightly different one. Here's what Tack Chumley says in his commentary. He says, Christ tells them, you don't know what you're asking, and proves it by asking whether they can drink his cup and undergo his baptism. He doesn't explain these terms, but to drink means to accept, to imbibe, or to endure, while cup and baptism are sometimes used as figures for suffering. Any suffering they anticipated was probably viewed as the military action necessary to establish a political kingdom, not the voluntary, redemptive suffering that's envisioned by Christ here. Okay. Now, Jesus does predict that James and John will indeed have their own cup to drink and will indeed have to suffer. What is it that we read about James and John which would prove that these prophecies of Jesus do come true? What, how do they both suffer in their own right?
James, one,
you're beheaded. Okay, James. James is the first apostle we read about being beheaded in Acts 12 and verse 2. And then John, how does he suffer? He's banished. When we read him writing in the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, he's exiled on the Isle of Patmos at the time. So he's suffering in a different way. And so Jesus actually knows you're going to go through suffering. It's not going to be right now, but you are going to drink that cup. You are going to be baptized with that baptism. And so he predicts their suffering as well. All right, we've got a couple of minutes left, but let's take a look at this text in Matthew 20, 24 through 28. When the ten heard it, here's how they feel about this request. They feel like this is a very somewhat arrogant request that you want to sit on these thrones with Jesus. And they began to be greatly displeased with James and John, the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself and said to them, you know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. Whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant. Whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. I'm just going to read to you a couple quotes here as we close, but this is from Wiersbe. He says, this disagreement gave Jesus the opportunity to teach a practical lesson on leadership. In his kingdom, we must not follow the examples of the world. He says, here's how the Gentiles operate. We're not operating by the same standards the Gentiles operate. He says, our example is Jesus, not some corporation president, not some wealthy celebrity. Jesus came as a servant, and therefore we should serve one another. He came to give his life, and therefore we should give our lives in service to him and others. The key to greatness is not found in position or power, but in character. There are many who want to exercise authority, but few who want to take the towel and the basin and wash feet. And this last week of Jesus, you see Jesus really emphasizing that. You know, if we were studying John, we would jump right into John 13 very soon after this, where that's exactly what he does. He says, I've got an example that I want to set for you, and I'm going to wash your dirty feet. I'm going to serve. And my disciples, you've got to learn how to serve one another if you're going to make this kingdom what Jesus wanted it to be. All right, we're out of time. Now, grab next week's lesson out of the back there. We're talking about Zacchaeus next week from the Gospel of Luke.